I am Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. To say that Emilia Samington-Fetty has had an eventful life would be an understatement. She has just published a radio play memoir, Trying to Be Good, and the Healing Powers of Lying, Cheating, Stealing, and Drugs. I don't know where to begin in terms of describing it. She grew up in a small town in British Columbia and recounts the tribulation and abuse she encountered growing up. This is particularly timely in the age of the Me Too movement, as Ms. Fetty discusses frankly the sexual assault that is prevalent in almost every woman's life. She talks about her father and mother, her own experience of motherhood, as well as looks at feminism, friendship, and the performing arts, where she's built a career as an artist, clown, and radio personality. This new audiobook is available from audible.com as well. More information can be found at Amelia's website at tryingtobegood.com. She joined me from Toronto earlier this week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Emilia Samington-Fetty. Ms. Fetty, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So you mentioned just before we started, you're in Toronto. Do you still live in Vancouver?
Yeah, I live in Vancouver with my kids and my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually in Toronto right now working with a friend on a stand-up comedy show, helping her write it and direct it.
I remember reading in the Georgia Strait that you were thinking of moving to Halifax last year.
We're going in August. Yeah,
I see. Yeah.
Yep.
So those feelings that you had about this city, I mean, everyone feels that though, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's still heartbreaking. I don't want to go. I wish I could stay, but I just need some security for the kids. Like, I just need to be able to open a door and them to be able to run outside. Like, I just, for my own mental health, and I don't have access to that. And Halifax was the closest place I could find in Canada where we could work as artists, and I could have a backyard.
Yeah. People should who are listening to us should look that up. That was the piece that you did in the Strait last summer, was it?
When I was in terror of being rent evicted and realized that my 3-bedroom home for my children, what I'd be able to afford if we were rent evicted, would have been a 1-bedroom basement suite. That's how much things have gone up since we moved.
Yeah.
And I realized I can't live with 2 toddlers and a husband in a 1-bedroom basement suite. And I put us all on a plane, and in 2 days, through my reptilian lobe, bought a house in Halifax.
So this book, this memoir that you've narrated that people can get on Audible, as I was telling you just before we started, just how enjoyable it is. I guess the best place to start is you're growing up. You ask your mother at one point, as you're growing up, are you rich or are we rich? And so I guess that's a good place to start in terms of what your childhood was like. Did you grow up rich?
Yeah, no, I grew up in a trailer in the bush, it's called, in BC. It was a small little box that was so hot in the summertime that we would just sit on the beach till about 10 or 11 at night and wait. And this sounds so silly, but we'd wait till the siding cooled down enough that we could go back into our house and sleep, because the siding was aluminum, so it would get really hot in the summer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are these funny stories of like, oh, back in my day, I had to, back in my day, I lived in a trailer where the siding was so hot, But the truth is that, we were poor. My mom was a single mom, and we had a garden so we could eat food, and we grew chickens so we could eat the chickens. Like, there was not a lot of there weren't grocery stores around. It was a very rural area, and she was a bit of a homesteader and really independent, fierce woman. So we made the garden bed and grew the chickens and kind of lived off the land, which of course now as an adult, I look back in a bit of a romantic way. I remember watching her can salmon over an open fire on the beach. How amazing is that, and of course, I'm almost 40 now, I think, well, I would love to be able to show my children how to do that, how to get those skills, but they're lost now.
Yeah. What was the relationship between your mother and father like?
It was quite not good. It was bad. My father left my mother, and this is in the book right off the top.
Yeah.
He left my mother when I was very, very young, like under a year, and he actually got her pregnant so that he could leave her. He didn't want to leave her alone. And then he left, and then she needed to support herself financially, and so she moved us to a different town that was 1,000 kilometers away, and my dad was very angry because he left her, but he didn't want to leave me. He loved me a lot. And so it was a very stressed and very aggressive relationship that was not fun to be around. And I spent my childhood kind of trying to take care of both of them and play the referee in that. And also a lot of the book is about that, the childhood, looking back at it with adult eyes and seeing how a child tries to parent their parents,
yeah.
you know, and deeply, deeply tries to take care of them and make sure that they're both happy, and how that's such a natural instinct for children. And now that I have my own children, I see it in them as well. And I go, okay, oh, wait, stop. Like, yeah. that's not cool. You know, I'm very aware that that is not okay.
Yeah, so you do realize that now.
Yeah.
That it wasn't fair for any kid.
Yes.
To have to go through that with one's parents, and especially your mom, because she had gotten sick, right?
Yeah. So then, of course, yeah, I mean, that's the hard thing, right? So my mom was sick with cancer when I was a teenager, and as a teenager, you've got no prefrontal cortex. Like, you're so self-absorbed that I really, truly, to hold myself back from the reality that my mom might die, you know, I'm 15, my mom might die. Like, what does that mean? I can't actually hold that thought in my head. And so I started behaving quite erratically, and I started making some really crazy decisions in my life.
Yeah.
Like, I lied to my boyfriend about being pregnant, and the whole town got involved in this ruse and thought I was pregnant. And I looking back on it now, I think, was it a bit of a psychotic break? Did something happen there that I had to go so into an imagination or into an imaginary world? Because the fact that I was scared that my mom was dying was so horrifying to me, I would rather be living in complete illusion. That's possible.
Yeah, there's a moment where you're scared about being found out. That you're not pregnant because I guess the former boyfriend takes you to the hospital,
yeah.
And you realize, oh, wait a minute, this is the hospital where my mom works and where she gets treatment. I might
yeah.
run into her, and it's not
yeah.
even a concern about her being sick. It's
no.
about running into her that you're really worried about, right?
Right, like, talk about selfishness. And this is another point for me. This is kind of, for me, the theme of this book, why I'm so quite proud of it,
yeah.
is that I am ruthless in looking at my imperfections,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I'm ruthless at, I tear a strip off myself every second word. Is like I'm not afraid to be like, yeah, that was crazy. Yeah, that was bad. Yeah, that was a bad move. Yeah, I messed up there. Like, and I think that's a very quite brave and feminist kind of act right now in
right.
the world, is to share as a woman like that, like, I'm a mess. I was a total mess. And here now I can have some analysis around it, and we can have conversation around it, and I can be smart about why I was a mess. But what about just letting all the mess hang out and
yeah.
and not trying to stuff the mess in? And that is something about this that it worked. I did it. I'm proud of it. I have people reading it going, you know, in 5 minutes, I hate you. I think you're nuts. And then the next 5 minutes, I'm in love with you. I want to call you. I'm crying. And you're
yeah.
my best friend. Like and that's called being a regular human.
Yeah, to make this about myself, as I'm listening to this, I'm about halfway through. I'm up to where you're in Vanuatu now.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess if I had read or heard this say, 5 years ago, before Me Too, before Time's Up, I would probably have judged you
mm-hmm.
because of your past. And now mm-hmm. I'm listening to this and learning about you, and I'm realizing that there's some wisdom in all the shit you had to go through to mm-hmm. get to where you are today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you write your memoir like that? I know there's some personal growth, some lessons that one has learned for themselves. But at all in the process of putting this together, do you want to impart some wisdom on your reader, your listener?
No, it's not intentional to do that at all. Well, honestly, the intention was to candidly share the story of the truth, right? Like, this is who I am. This is what I did. Very just honest, truthful behavior about that I am imperfect and, you know, I'm a mess sometimes and that's okay. And I'm still, like, I have regrets. Like, there's regrets I have around my mother. There's regrets about how I treated her. I still want to fall to my knees sometimes with shame around my behavior as a daughter towards her, you know, as a teenager, while she was dying even. But through the process of writing and then reading the memoir, of course, self-compassion comes in. Of like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There's reasons. Like, you do things for reasons. You do things because you're in trauma. You do it because you've been hurt. And so then with the compassion that I can then give myself around my story, then the hope is that the readers can have some compassion for themselves around their stories, right? It's like, yeah. If I can tell you the complete and utter nut job behavior that I have engaged in, and you can laugh at that, and you can see that as human and okay, and you can still like me, then you can do that for yourself too. Now, obviously that's not, I don't want to ever give a message. I'm not a message giver,
mm-hmm.
but that's the little secret message.
Yeah. And do you think that this harshness that you view yourself with, it is unfair for my read of it, because, I mean, you were quite young when a lot
uh-huh.
of this stuff went down, right?
Well, that's nice of you to say.
Yeah. I mean you were smart, and you were mature for your age, if you will. But I mean, you know, I'm willing to cut someone slack if they made some mistakes when they were a kid, right?
Mm-hmm. And aren't you? But I mean, there were mistakes that I made when I wasn't a kid, right? Like,
sure,
I went
sure. yeah.
and lied to a guru about, like, trying to get into a yoga course that would get me into this elite yoga program. Like, I lied to a living spiritual master when I was 32. Like,
yeah.
I stole things from people when I was in my 30s. I cheated on my partner. Like, I did some really crappy stuff to people. I got addicted to pills and smoked drugs when I was pregnant. You know, like, that's not good. That's bad. That's not good behavior. So to be candid about that, to say that, as an adult, I did some crappy stuff, okay? But why, okay?
Yeah.
Well, because my mom was dying, because I was terrified, because I didn't know if I could be a mom, because, like, there's reasons for things. So I keep throwing in, I throw the truth really harshly at the wall, and then I look at it and go, okay, so, again, where's the compassion or the reason for why someone would behave in this way? And then I can soften up on myself a little bit. Was it okay that I smoked weed when I was pregnant? Is that okay? Do I feel good about that? No, I don't feel good about that. But guess what? My kids are awesome. They're really smart.
Yeah.
And I was in trauma. I was in complete and utter trauma. So give myself a break.
Sure.
So to all the moms out there who aren't perfect, who didn't make do the bake sale this week, well, I'm worse than you. Give yourself a break.
So does the writing of it, for you, I mean, does it make for a better life? I mean, are you able to get over some of these regrets that you might have had?
Well, when my husband listened, he said, wow, I feel so much more, like, compassion for you now. I really understand why, you know, you might be kind of tough to live with sometimes. Like, it kind of gave him a little bit of a of a of a bigger picture of why I am the complicated, lovely mess that I may be at times, right? Yeah. And just, you know, like owning that, like that humans are allowed to be complicated, amazing messes sometimes, and that they're still allowed to be loved, and they're still allowed to have families, and they're still allowed to be successful, you know? Like, just, I like to say that, like, the only money I've ever made is when I've shared the worst parts of myself with the world.
Yeah.
That's the only way I've ever made connection is when I share the dark truth about myself. And people go, oh, thank God, you know? Me too. And then we can just, you know, relax a little bit about that. And yeah, then I can, I mean, there is something freeing in me sharing the story, and then I get to see it from a bird's eye view, right?
Yeah.
I get to look down on it, kind of like, you know, a guardian angel would, or, you know, you look down at your childhood or your life and you go, oh, you sweet thing.
Yeah, it has been quite an eventful life. A theatrical life, and looking at your career. I mean, I suppose it was a given.
Yes, right? Yeah. I mean, I was like lying about weird stuff, like a python in my house, and like my imagination just was so extreme and bold, and I knew, like, at the, you know, chapter one, like, when I got clapped for on that birthday night at age 5, I knew this is my job. I'm going to be clapped for. Now, the sad part is, right, is that I still to this day struggle with being loved, like, by the people who love me just for who I am, like, my partner, my father, my brother, my kids, they just go, I love you, Amelia, because you're my mom or you're my partner, right?
Mm.
I still have this longing, this desire or need to have outside affirmation, right? You're worth it. You deserve to be clapped for.
Mm.
And that's sad. That's a trauma. And I acknowledge that. And I acknowledge that comes from being a latchkey kid, having a single mom, having a dad who wasn't all that great all the time. That's where that comes from, is this, please see me and please tell me I'm okay. And then I get the affirmation and I can take a deep breath. I'm working on now, I'm turning 40 in a month, and my goal for the year of 40 is to just let myself be loved by the people who love me.
Mm. Yeah,
you know, stop trying to get so many Instagram followers.
Yeah, but it is a life that I guess was meant for the page or the stage, wasn't it? I mean, and when you look back at it, because regrets are such a terrible thing to have to deal with,
mm-hmm.
And we all deal with them whether we want to or not. I'm wondering when you have to relive it as you do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it was worth it at all?
To relive the stories?
Or what you went through, to have to go through what you went through to get to where we are today?
Yeah. Well, you know, I would do anything for my mother not to have died.
Right.
I would do anything for that, you know? Like, I would, I wish she didn't die. I wish she had her grandchildren. I still feel 4 years later just gutted completely, and you know, there's moments in the day where I just go, oh, I don't know if I can breathe, you know, like,
yeah.
I still am surprised and shocked, so that, no, that I don't, that's the one thing, you know, like, I wish the magical fairy would bring mom back to me. I think probably everyone who loses a parent probably feels that way. It's a big loss. But everything else, yeah, it's fine. You know, like, all my good stories come from just the crappiest thing, right? Like, just making an utter fool of myself, like, just failing miserably, just going to the top of a mountain and lying to a famous person to try and manipulate to get what I want. Like what a good story that is.
Yeah.
It was a horrible experience stealing something from a yoga studio, like lying to people. Like, yeah, but in the end, of course, it's they all my trauma, pain, and horrible experiences, like, they make hilarious tales.
Yeah, they do.
That we can laugh at and we can go, holy jeez, like, and there's such release in that, you know, and I just feel like I feel like I should have a t-shirt made that says clown for life. Like, whether I like it or not, I'm a clown. Like, I'm just a clown. Like, I'm the person tripping up, messing up, and then I use it and I put it into my art and I turn it into something that we can laugh and learn and kind of feel together a bit on. And the irony also is in the book is there's so much self-help, right? Like,
right.
This addiction, this constant, like, will a shaman do it? Will a yoga, another yoga certification do it? Will, like, opening the cosmic grid do it? Will banging on a drum do it? Like, what's going to be the thing that's going to heal me? What's going to be the thing that makes me feel better? What's going to be the thing that brings love to me? Like, the obsession with this addiction, this kind of self-help addiction.
Yeah.
And then, but the irony of this is that some of this work I've done, the self-help work I've done, it has been what's made me be okay with the mess.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's a bit of a dichotomy there.
Yeah. So for people listening to this, Amelia goes through a lot of different phases where she tries different things because she does realize she's got a problem that she needs to fix, and she seeks help from everybody. I guess that's where the title comes from, trying to be good.
Mm-hmm.
You do learn from each thing, though, right? I mean, you do learn something new about yourself after each thing, whether you realize it then or not. Certainly
yeah,
now.
Usually,
taking it, yeah,
usually. Sometimes I learn, sometimes the things I learn is that intuitive via Skype ripped me off. Like, sometimes that's what I learn, you know, like,
yeah.
You should... You know, like, I've spent thousands of dollars on online courses, for example, and this is hilarious. This is because, like, here I am writing a book about my self-help addiction and the grief of the loss of my mother and trying to be a mom when I don't have a mom and I don't really want to be a mom, right? And I'm talking about this self-help addiction, and while I'm doing it, I'm online looking for courses that will help me sell the book.
Mm.
So I'm actively engaged in my addiction while I'm writing the book about the addiction. And I take this course. It's like 9 months. It costs thousands of dollars. And at the end of it, it was illegal. It was an illegal course.
Yeah.
It was a lie. It didn't work. And it's just like the comedy, the tragic comedy of that. I'm writing a book about a self-help addiction in the throes of a self-help addiction. And when will I learn? When will I bloody learn?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not, nothing is going to fix it. No one's going to fix it. You just got to crawl in bed and you've got to feel it.
Yeah.
That's what you got to do. You got to get into the dark, dark, dark place, pull the covers up, and you got to feel it. And that's what I'm slowly, carefully learning to do.
Well, one of the things that as I'm listening to the book that I find fascinating is the theme of friendship that you explore.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons of friendship,
mm-hmm.
are they different for you because you're female and the friends that you generally had were female friends,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, say, for guys? Because I'm a guy. I'm talking to you about listening to your life story here, I'm wondering if you have learned anything about friendship. I mean, this theme in the book about expecting too much from friendship,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think resonates with everybody.
Does it? Does it resonate for you as well as a man?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You hear that thing, I'm sure people have read this, you know, online about how hard it is to make friends after 30.
Yes.
And I'm feeling that quite acutely as I'm 36.
Yeah.
I'm turning 36.
Yeah. There's a, it's, and especially when you move into, like, there's the breeder zone and then the non-breeder zone and then the friendships separate further. And, yeah, I mean, the main, for me, like, the image for me, and this is what is one of the chapters is called Stand By Me for Girls. And that image for me of the movie Stand By Me, right?
Yeah.
And the boys on the tracks and that youthful, that youthfulness, the innocence before, the dark, right?
Yeah.
Before the horror hits. And that beautiful bond that was unbreakable between them, right? Before things get in the way, like, you know, sexuality and jobs and whatever. And there was this moment in time of complete, utter, you're in love with your friends and nothing can break that bond. And that, you know, that to me is the best healing you can get, is that connection with friends. Like, that is better than any pill or drug or self-help course or anything, is sitting down with a group of friends and feeling really connected and supported and loved, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you get that as a man. I know that I work really hard to maintain it as a woman. Like, I have the dinner parties. I work hard. Now, it doesn't happen very often anymore. Like, everyone is just so busy, right?
Yeah.
But for me, it's the greatest healer is just, like, a room full of women laughing, talking, being really, really honest about what's going on is the most deeply fulfilling sensation. Like, for my 40th birthday, I'm having a dinner party that's just women.
Mm.
Like, my husband's not even invited.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know for you, I don't know if men get that gift of that male bonding. I don't know if men, especially in this culture anyway, get the gift. Do you? Do you have strong male friendships?
Yeah, I do. But there's a moment in your book where you talk about, I guess I can't remember what was happening in your life, where you thought to yourself, well, you realize, I should say, that you're the organizer.
Yeah.
And that maybe let's see what happens when I don't do anything.
Yeah.
And then you realize, well, you're just expecting so much of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out that you guys just drift apart because you don't do anything.
Yeah.
And I guess I feel that somewhat. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if I feel it, but I certainly understand what you were going through.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what happened. It's just like, hey, wait a minute. Like, the wedding planner stopped planning the weddings, and then all of a sudden, like, the dance card was empty. Like, nobody called, nobody visited, nobody. I was the organizer, and that was a real loss. And I do honestly believe that it would be really, really great if we could all be as committed to friendship as we should be. Like, I do believe that friendship saves marriages. Friendship, like, keeps you off the ledge. Like, you know, like, that's who you go to when it's like, I'm going to run for the hills. Your friend talks you down. I do believe friendship, like, you know, and also, like, learning from other people, you know, learning from other women, learning from, you know, like, just, yeah, so much opportunity there for growth and self-reflection. And so what I've done now is I've just kind of quietly taken on the role of organizer again, but it's now more by choice rather than by resentment. I'm like, you know what? I really want friends, so I'm just going to do it.
Yeah. Have you found it easier to make new friends, say?
Good question. I probably make a new friend, like, every 5 years,
yeah.
You know, and then we have to kind of maintain it, get to know each other, like, suss it out a little bit. Like, it's hard. It's hard to make new friends. It's weird, right? Especially when you've had friends for 20 years. It's like, what? You don't know that I don't like bananas? Like, well, you know, like, it's weird. Yeah.
I guess, men do have friends, in like women do, in close. But I guess most guys I know don't need it as often, maybe. I don't know how to put that, but I mean, what I mean?
Yeah,
it's not as intense, if you will.
Yeah, maybe the need, I mean, there's that thing that's like women talk like 100,000 words a day and men talk 5,000 words a day. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, some crazy stat like that. Like, I definitely get filled by communication, you know?
Yeah.
Yakking. That really does it for me. It does not. My husband doesn't need to yak, you know?
Yeah.
He'll listen to my yaks, but he doesn't need to yak along right beside me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of like this. I mean, you've done most of the talking. I've done most of the listening. I find that a little bit goes a long way in terms of friendship. I mean, you don't need to see your friends as regularly as you think you need to, but a little bit goes a long way, and I think that's enough. And unfortunately for a lot of people, I mean, this epidemic of loneliness, not enough people are doing that or thinking about that as they should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point. Like, it's medicine.
Mm-hmm. I could talk all day with you. This has been such a fun conversation for me because I'm enjoying your memoir a great deal.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, and I hope a lot of people pick it up because it's got all the stuff that I guess we need now. I mean, we need to know what's happening with women and just how inherent the abuse is that women suffer on a daily basis almost.
Yeah, and also I think an interesting point is how the people reading the book now can go like, oh, so you might have some issues in bed with me, your partner, whatever, because of what happened to you when you were a kid or a teenager. Like, there's follow through of like, oh, and for me even to say, so all those things, every weekend, every weekend was a Me Too weekend. Like, every weekend there was something bad happened that I didn't even know was a sexual assault at the time. I thought it was just what it was. But, of course, I see it. I go, well, that was all sexual assault. That was really bad behavior on their parts. And I'm actually working through that now with my partner. I'm working through trauma from age 13 to 18, now at age 40.
Yeah.
And for people to notice that and recognize that in themselves that, oh, like the healing might be coming up decades later.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing. That's a great, great thing.
It explains to a lot of us who might think, well, if something bad happened, then why didn't they say anything? Well, sometimes when you're 13, you don't understand what's happening, right?
No idea.
Yeah.
No, I had no idea. Absolutely no clue. I thought it was my job.
Yeah.
Perform.
Yeah.
Just perform. I had no idea that no was even a word.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting, right?
Yeah.
So times have changed. Times are changing.
Yeah.
Things are happening, are moving quite quickly. And this is, it's a good, it's a pretty amazing, for me it's kind of a great how the book has come out at this kind of perfect timing, talking about all this stuff. Me Too and what now and this kind of the madness of the self-help industry and how it's kind of, you know, turning us into like these, you know, junkies on the search for meaning and, you know, not being comfortable with just feeling pain. It's all pretty timely stuff.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great service and beyond that, it's just an entertaining, time to sit down and listen to your memoir. Congratulations on this and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Visit tryingtobegood.com. The book is called Trying to Be Good and the Healing Powers of Lying, Cheating, Stealing, and Drugs. Audible.com has it. Amelia Semington-Fetty joined me on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.